So my name is Deb Sedlak. I'm a member of the Nurse Advisory Committee at the Immune Deficiency Foundation. And this morning session is immunoglobulin therapy and overview. We have divided it into two 15-minute talks. Dr. Mark Ballow will be speaking on IVIG. Dr. Ballow is the former Chief Division of Allergy and Immunology at the Women and Children's Hospital of Buffalo and the State University of New York, Buffalo School of Medicine. He is currently an affiliate faculty member at the University of South Florida, Department of Pediatrics and Medicine. Our second speaker will be focusing on sub-Q administration. That is Dr. John Sleesman. He is professor and division chief of pediatric allergy, immunology, pulmonology, and sleep medicine at Duke University School of Medicine in Durham, North Carolina. He treats individuals diagnosed with the aforementioned diseases, and he also happens to be my boss. So the way that this format will be, we'll have two 15-minute sessions where they will address the topic, and then we will take questions at the end of the session. And if you feel like your question has not been answered, there are two sessions, repeating sessions this afternoon for questions on immune replacement administration, and one is from 3:15 to 4, and one is before that. And I'm on that panel. So please, if you feel like you haven't had your questions answered here, come to one of those sessions. Dr. Ballow? Got other questions? If you have questions, hold them up like that, and team members will come and pick them up. So I think, there you go. Good to go. I'll give you the high five.
Okay. Thanks, Deb. So I think the purpose of this session is to give an overview of immunoglobulin replacement therapy. And I'm going to spend the 15 minutes, a little bit of a historic background, and just talk about IV route of immunoglobulin replacement therapy. And Dr. Sleesman is going to concentrate, I think, on sub-Q. So that's the plan. So I don't know if I'm supposed to show these disclosures, but here they are. And I think some of these slides you've seen in the past, either from reading material or from past talks at the IDF meeting. As you know, immunoglobulin is made from a fairly large donor pool, 2,000 to 10,000 donors. The FDA limits it to a top donor pool of 60,000 donors, and that's maybe of historical interest because around the year 2000 or so, there was a quarantine of products that led to a shortfall of a product, and that was because that the donor pool that was in one particular brand of gamma globulin was much, much more than 60,000 donors. The composition is mostly pure IgG, which is the antibodies that we're looking for to protect the patient against a variety of types of infections. There are small amounts of other proteins in there, including IgM and IgA, and that varies from product to product and has always come up, and it may come up in the Q&A session about the issue about IgA and some of the products, but I'll leave it there. Just for some trivia, if you'd like to play Trivial Pursuit, 1 gram of gamma globulin contains 4 × 10^18 molecules of antibody, so it's very diverse, very broad spectrum of specific antibodies. And this is what protects you against a variety of potential pathogens, both bacterial and viral. All the products have other components as well. Some of them have sugars, but many of the products have gravitated away from sugars and have used amino acids kind of to stabilize and to allow the IgG to stay in what we call a monomeric form that is non-aggregated, because we realized back in the 80s that if it was aggregated, it caused a lot of side effects. So this is just, I like this slide because it kind of traces the history of where we've come from. During World War II, Cohn developed a method of purifying the gamma globulin portion of plasma, and it was actually used as to protect soldiers against pathogens such as tetanus. and obviously protected against a number of other infectious agents as well that soldiers saw during World War II. So the first, and this was used as a intramuscular preparation of the gamma globulin. And my mentor, Bao, back in 1951-52, realized that this was a tremendous source for partially replacing gamma globulin in patients who could not make specific antibodies or had very low amounts of gamma globulin. Robert Good in Minnesota and Fred Rosen in Boston at the time. And this really kind of kicked off this whole arena of clinical immunology and patients with primary immune deficiency disorders. But we realized, or those investigators realized at the time, there was a limitation of how much you can actually administer into the muscle. So they explored other modalities for replacing gamma globulin, the IgG fraction, using plasma therapy, for example. But the first intravenous preparations were not approved until 1981. So it took a long time of experimentation by modifying the IgG molecule to make sure it didn't aggregate to cause, you know, minimal or less side effects. So even though there was a lot going on in the 70s, it wasn't until 1981 that there were two products approved by the FDA for use in patients with immune deficiency. So this is the FDA-approved indications for IVIG, and the top of the list, of course, is primary immune deficiency disorders, and there's no other alternative therapy, and we're always reminding our colleagues in other disciplines, like in neurology and rheumatology, hematology, that there's no alternative therapy. This is it. And I think we've been very successful. Luckily, I think we have a number of products in the United States available now, so I don't anticipate any shortage that occurred around 2000 when there was a lot of discussion at advisory boards and pharmacy therapeutic committees about who had priority in receiving these gamma globulin products. There are two recent indications approved by the FDA, chronic inflammatory polyneuropathy and multifocal motor neuropathy, just out of interest. So what has certainly through observation and research, so some of the research that you all may have participated, we realize that immunoglobulin not only is important as replacement therapy to protect patients against infection, but it's also used by our colleagues in hematology, rheumatology, neurology as an immune modifying modality. And obviously the dosing is much different under those circumstances. I don't have time to go into that, but that's kind of an interesting evolving story about the immune modulating properties of the IgG molecule. We realized early on in the 1980s when these products were first approved by the FDA that there were consequences, adverse reactions. I'm sure that they're all known to you because your doctor probably discusses these in detail. I have to say with more recent preparations that use amino acids as stabilizers, we see a lot less of these side effects, these common reactions due, as I said before, to the IgG kind of aggregating together to cause some of these symptoms. Many of these reactions are rate-related, and so therefore, and again, I'm sure you've experienced this, if a patient does run into some problems with these reactions, we slow down the IV administration so that they occur a lot less. We also have some other modalities such as pretreatment, either, you know, with acetaminophen or non-steroidal anti-inflammatories or Benadryl, and that helps a lot of times with patients with some of these minor reactions. Rarely we have to go to steroids, you know, small doses of steroids is another option. There are certainly some more significant adverse events that I'm sure you're all aware because you're informed consumers, if I might put it that way. And I don't know if I have this on the subsequent slide. Let me just see. Let me just peek. No, I guess I don't. But one of the adverse events that we are certainly worried about over the past decade is thromboembolic events, leading to serious consequences such as stroke, myocardial infarction, deep vein thrombosis, pulmonary embolism, etc. We think we now understand what has caused that. There was a lot of discussion over the years whether it was related to a particular product, whether it was related to too much sodium in the product, but we now realize that it was probably related to some other minor component in the gamma globulin that varies from product to product. It's a procoagulant enzyme that actually kicks off the coagulation system that seemed in certain patients seemed to lead to these embolic phenomena. Mostly not so much in patients with primary immune deficiency, but mostly in patients with autoimmune disease that are getting a very, very large dose of gamma globulin to modulate their autoimmune process. So one of the most frequent questions I get, of course, is what about the safety of gamma globulin overall, whether it's IV or sub-Q? And I have to say that I think we're at a point that all these products are pretty darn safe. You know, there's been a number of changes over the years from, I'm sorry, I don't have a pointer, so I can't walk you through these slides as I wish I could. But it starts with donor screening, you know, which has evolved quite sophisticated over the past decade or two. And then donor testing. So they, you know, they take a sample of blood and they do all kinds of testing on that donor's blood to make sure that they haven't come in contact with a pathogen, a particular bacteria or virus that might be an issue in making any plasma product, whether it's gamma globulin or albumin or whatever. And all the gamma globulin now is the plasma is derived from plasmapheresis of normal individual donors. Most of these donor centers are in smaller towns, college towns, whereas maybe 25 years ago, you know, it was in San Francisco and Washington and New York, and the plasmapheresis centers have moved out of these large cities because it was realized that the donors in those larger cities would be more at risk for contributing tainted plasma. There's a number of steps in not only testing the donor and the plasma that's derived from that donor, but also in the processing of the gamma globulin, there's some, you know, very sophisticated processes that would remove viruses such as HIV, and that was realized early on in the 1980s that occurred with one of the early steps of the gamma globulin purification. And one of the latest changes is something called depth filtration, and nanofiltration is a very sophisticated filter that can filter out large particles. And that was developed because of concern of prion disease or mad cow disease that appeared in Europe about almost two decades ago. So I think, you know, we have a product now that is pretty darn safe. You can never say never in medicine, but I don't recall anything in the literature recently that has elevated anyone's anxiety about transmission of any sort of pathogen from our gamma globulin products to date. So I kind of summarized this already. So, you know, there's been an interesting evolution of gamma globulin products, and not to get too much in depth, but as I said before, the early products had problems because the IgG aggregated together and caused all these side effects that you're probably familiar with, chills, back pain, low-grade fever, et cetera, and we're kind of got through that by changing the manufacturing process. So if we could just skip down here to the fourth generation, additional antiviral steps. And where we go from this, it's difficult to say. I think, you know, the manufacturers are still interested in coming up with a product with even additional safety measures. I'll just mention one in particular that they're looking at. Because the immunoglobulin products contain a broad spectrum of antibodies, some of the products, or most of the products, actually contain antibodies to some of the blood group antigens, like the ABO blood group antigens. And there's some steps to try to eliminate those antibodies to make them even safer. So why don't I switch this over? I didn't talk about dosing so much, but there's been a kind of an evolution in the dose of administration of gamma globulin. Back when we used IM gamma globulin, it was 0.6 cc's per kilo, which would not raise the gamma, your serum IgG level, more than a couple hundred, up to 100 or 200. And then there was a lot of excitement, obviously, with IV, because getting the IV route, we can push a lot more of the gamma globulin and raise the serum IgG level up to 500 milligrams per deciliter. And for a long time, we thought that was kind of the magic number. And then there's been some more recent literature over the past 5 or 6 years, and that your physician may have shared with you, that we now think that the optimal serum IgG trough, or steady state IgG, is closer to around 800, 850 milligrams per deciliter. But it's very patient dependent. Some patients may require less, and some patients may require higher doses. So, and that's, I heard this in the other session about the biological trough level, which just means that's the ideal IgG level that's appropriate for an individual patient. So I think I'm going to limit my discussion there and ask Dr. Sleesman to talk about sub-Q gamma globulin.